I've been asked to chair the session. So we're looking at post-existentialism in practice. We've got two speakers. We're looking at practice and post-existentialism. We've got two people talking about their work in this area. First will be Tom Cotton, and then will be Rhiannon. I was thinking that the people involved in presenting papers here, their backgrounds are either in visual arts or in nursing. So that's a combination amongst other things. But both these people here, both Tom and Rhiannon, have a background in visual arts, and they're talking about their research. Hyer Oakley's the respondent. Hyer's a psychoanalyst in private practice in London, and she'll be responding. So what we're looking for is up to 20 minutes from Tom and from Rhiannon, followed by Hyer, and then open to the floor. So if we could ask Tom to start looking at Lang, the treatment is the way we treat people. Tom.
I stand or sit?
I don't know. Do you want to use this again for the word of the world? Well, is that
okay. How's that? Is that? Can you hear that?
Yes.
Great. Okay. So I hope you bear with me. I'm going to read from something that I've prepared because I'm useless at delivering this sort of thing off the cuff. Okay, so what we're exploring today are differing approaches toward a post-existential attitude to psychotherapy and how these might apply in differing settings such as psychotherapeutic training or research, for example. In the chapter called Lang and the Treatment is the Way that We Treat People, Del and I explored these ideas in relation to psychotherapy practice and what might be considered a key post-existential concern, how to remain open to what emerges in the treatment relationship without the temptation to close this down with treatment theory. The gap between treatment practice and treatment theory could be seen as a slippery liminal space, which should and does challenge everything, even our most basic assumptions about theory and the knowledge structures on which it is based. This space can provide an opportunity for valuable exploration, reflection and learning, and yet all too often the uncertainty that arises here is met by the attempt to shut this space down or simply ignore it and retreat behind entrenched psychological therapized positions. What has been referred to as R.D. Lang's existential analytic could be seen as one important starting point for a post-existential approach. From a post-existential perspective, one could say that perhaps Lang's greatest achievement was his claim that the contents of the psychoses was meaningful and intelligible, providing that one could look past the obstacle of the investigating eye and retain an open space where the historical, temporal, and cultural context of the other's design could be explored. In challenging the mental health orthodoxies of the 1960s, Lang and his colleagues attempted to keep the space open without defining it in a positivistic way. Kingsley Hall was a protean therapeutic community that Lang was instrumental in setting up and opened in 1965, before disintegrating in 1970. Kingsley Hall has been described as many things: pioneering, controversial, a chaotic countercultural extravagance, amongst others. From a post-existential perspective, it could also be said to be an attempt to create a treatment setting that emphasized the intersubjective, relational aspect of a therapeutic encounter, and where the intention might have been said to keep something open and to put practice first. So how the chapter came about. In 2007, I was commissioned by the Wellcome Trust to research and develop a documentary and feature film, both exploring Lang's work and the Kingsley Hall community. The research interviews were filmed with participants in Kingsley Hall, Ira amongst them, and other of Lang's peers, such as John Heaton, who will be presenting later today, as well as a client in a contemporary therapeutic community. These interviews also form the data for the psychotherapy research I was conducting at the same time. As both film and psychotherapy research progressed, the emerging grey areas between theoretical idealism and the reality of practice in Kingsley Hall's Experiment and Living seemed to be an important terrain when exploring the gap between treatment theory and practice from a post-existential perspective. So how are these concerns relevant in today's treatment setting? Despite the many varieties of psychotherapy available, mainstream mental health is dominated by the medical model. That's perhaps arguable. Which has seen the colonisation of the psychological and social by the biological, that's according to Richard Bentall. This colonisation is further reinforced by research economics. The vast majority of money available for research comes from the pharmaceutical industry, which has a vested interest in finding biological origins to mental disorders that only their drugs can manage or treat. This framework then inevitably shapes what is seen to take place in practice and in turn feeds back into treatment theory. Because this narrow materialistic interpretation of mental health struggles to quantify the complex relationship between culture, power, the unconscious, language, and the other myriad agencies that human experience is subject to, these areas are consigned to the non-scientific ghetto, where they can be safely disregarded. In this current treatment monoculture, are we able to ask difficult yet important questions about the medical model-friendly forms of therapy, such as CBT, for example, which endorse some of the medical model's assumptions? Can these modes of therapy be seen as a way of not thinking about something? While not thinking about something, the cause of deeper troubling mechanisms, for instance, might be useful at times, but potentially catastrophic as a principal approach to well-being, as Del has mentioned earlier. So in revisiting Kingsley Hall, we could consider the following questions. Lange said that the treatment is the way that we treat people, but is that really what happened? Was Kingsley Hall a setting where psychological therapies could start with practice? How might an approximation of post-existential values have been put into practice in a treatment setting? And what might we draw from these questions in relation to Kingsley Hall, even though the culture might have changed? So how the research was carried out? My 2007 psychotherapy research asked, what relationship, if any, is there between the way that we treat people and the treatment in psychotherapy? The research used Moustakas's 1990 heuristic method, where by immersing themselves in the research subject and participants interview data, the researcher encourages a spirit of self-discovery in which aspects of indwelling tacit knowledge might illuminate the research process. The research findings were clustered around five main themes which attempted to represent the experiences of the participants. And the first theme was this. Good treatment, in inverted commas, involves respecting the other as an individual. This theme embodied an ideal of what treatment should be for the research participants. And this ideal was seen as the following. Respecting the patient as an individual, the therapist should attempt to enter into a dialogue with the patient's experienced world. Psychiatric diagnostic rigidity ultimately has a negative impact on a patient's sense of self and identity. People are not closed units, and that in appreciating the patient's experienced world, the therapist must appreciate the wider context of mental illness, principally its interpersonal character, whether as an expression of a relationship between two people, members of a family, social groups, or different cultures. There is a relationship between darkness and deeper understanding. Attempting to split off this darkness robs the individual of fundamental and necessary aspects of human experience, along with the ability to learn how to negotiate this experience. So the second theme is bad treatment, again in inverted commas, is a consequence of ignoring the other's individuality. Failing to enter into some kind of dialogue with the patient's experienced world was seen to have a detrimental and sometimes dehumanising effect. Bad treatment was seen as manifesting in the following ways. The inherent problem in attempting to observe humans from a materialistic scientific perspective. A materialistic scientific lens which underpins the medical model can lead to unwitting the damaging effects in treatment practice. Rigid diagnosis, an expression of materialistic scientific thinking, may obscure the identity of the person behind it. This person and their unique life experiences may be at variance with their diagnostic identity, leading to a potential further loss of actual identity. The certainty that psychiatric diagnosis alludes to fits too neatly with the pharmaceutical industry and insurance industry interests. This distorts what is observed in practice. Psychiatric hospitals are rarely therapeutic environments, rather containers where medication was seen as the main treatment tool. So the third theme was Kingsley Hall attempted to be a model of good treatment. Having given some consideration to what they felt was an ideal of good treatment and what constituted bad treatment, participants talked about how, at its inception, Kingsley Hall represented the attempt to put these ideas into practice. Prominent themes in this third thematic group were: Kingsley Hall was a social experiment, a reaction against conservatism in mental health treatment in a wider society, and in wider society. Kingsley Hall was a reaction against 1950s psychiatry, which mirrored society's fear of madness. Materialistic society fears the depths of human experience and needs to defend its self-protective, superficial way of living. Kingsley Hall was seen as a sanctuary where people could remove themselves from these social agencies and the methods of treatment that claimed to represent them. Kingsley Hall was seen as a space where people could experiment and experience each other beyond what was seen as repressive social structures. So the fourth theme was where Kingsley Hall failed to be a model of good treatment. This was where the gap between the treatment ideal and the treatment practice revealed itself. Prominent themes were as follows. Kingsley Hall could not meet the reality of living in a supposedly leaderless group, where some very disturbed behaviour was acted out, not all of it, by the non-patients. Despite the rhetoric, treatment and theory power structures were inevitably engaged with, but made more destructive by the need to disguise them because they contradicted the community's polemic. Using LSD to facilitate a shared psychotic experience between non-patients and non-therapists only seemed to highlight their difference. When the ideal that residents, regardless of the degree of their illness, could become well solely on the basis of being freed from the pathological tangles of society and treated as individuals, began to appear to be yet another utopian myth, a sense of disillusionment set in. Despite the non-leader rhetoric, Lang was seen as the biggest ego on the block. Where this unacknowledged hierarchy was rationalised away or flatly denied, the community demonstrated perfectly the very kind of double binds, knots and layers of mystification that Lang had recognised in society at large in the first place. And the fifth theme was some consequences of good treatment, in inverted commas, lacking clear structures. Kingsley Hall was seen as an expression of a time and a place that most participants did not wish to see replicated. Acknowledging this, participants also felt that in lacking a clear way to deliver a practice based on Lang's theory, Kingsley Hall failed to deliver an alternative to mainstream psychiatric treatment. And the prominent themes in this group were as follows. Today's mental health system is overregulated. This was partially seen as a consequence of the wider social trend of pathologizing existential life issues. Participants feared the net result of this trend would be ever-increasing restrictions imposed in psychotherapy practice. Medical model demands for certainty and standardised treatment threatens the values of psychotherapy and forces practitioners into a defensive form of practice. Lack of public engagement in mental health issues was seen as extending into the psychotherapeutic community's lack of engagement with political aspects of mental health issues, such as psychotherapy regulation. There is a lack of questioning in mental health by both patients and practitioners because of the fear of gnawing human uncertainties at the heart of the work and the resultant preoccupation with attempting to get things right. So, some implications for post-existential theory in practice. Each of these main themes seems to suggest that the way that we treat one another as individuals has a profound effect on the treatment, and that the theories we generate in order to deliver this treatment have as much capacity to do violence to the other as they have to do good, especially when attached to the theory in all its forms: academic distinction, professional certainty, needing to deliver standardised treatment pathways, etc. This prevents a recognition that we may that what may emerge in the here and now of the therapeutic relationship does not conform to this theory. The Kingsley Hall community may have demonstrated that whether one works with a system of diagnostic labels, psychiatric, psychoanalytic, behavioural or otherwise, or a non-system of non-labels, when this system or non-system ceases to regard the other's experience with phenomenological openness, then this experience becomes co-opted into the ongoing maintenance of the system or non-system's epistemological support structures, and the otherness of the individual becomes invariably lost. The aspiration to have no system meant that Kingsley Hall seemed to lose itself in the confusion of adhering to an unacknowledged system whose existence had to be denied to keep the non-system intact. It sounds like a classic Langian knot, and it might well be. If nothing else, in attempting to purge the treatment setting of the hierarchies, double binds, knots and layers of mystification that he found in wider society, and succeeding in unwittingly acting them out in Kingsley Hall, Lang may have inadvertently proved his theory. So what can we conclude for this? Might then a post-existential framework open up a space where we can think about these intersubjective issues of culture, power, language, and experience from a critical point of view, while attempting to retain our focus on the face of the other, in Levinas's words, who entreats us to ethical responsibility rather than the self-interested concerns of the I? In so doing, can we resist the temptation to weave what we find in this open space into yet another totalizing theory? And what about a place for post-existential research? Can phenomenological research enable this open space? Or do research methods, such as the method of heuristic research, as in this chapter, do a similar injustice to the other? During the writing of this chapter with Dell, I began filming a documentary exploring the experiences of people who have received the diagnosis of schizophrenia. I found that the ideas explored in this chapter encouraged me to keep open a space in which discovery could happen while trying to negotiate the tension between the need to present a coherent narrative, not unlike a research narrative, on the one hand, and attempting to put the other, or research subject, first on the other hand. This approach has also provided a framework for me to attempt to manage similar tensions in my current work, project managing a therapeutic community for people experiencing psychosis, working in my one-to-one psychotherapy practice, and conducting my current experiential research, which explores whether psychotherapy has been helpful or not for people who have received the diagnosis of schizophrenia. In the course of this work, an image has often come to mind in which theory is used to build a bridge across an expanse of water to an unexplored piece of land, perhaps the experience of the other. Once across, the bridge needs to be deconstructed and packed away. And once the land is explored, what has been learned will shape the new bridge required to cross over to the next piece of unexplored land. With each new expanse of water to traverse, the bridge needs to be constructed in a different way, ready to fit its task, shaped by both the theory of how to build the bridge and what has been learned by experience, but dictated by neither. When exploring the gap between treatment theory and treatment practice, there are many more questions than answers. Perhaps a post-existential framework might help us to sit with the uncertainty of these questions and allow us to remain open to what comes to mind, rather than starting with theory. To achieve this attempt to keep open, retaining an ongoing scepticism of post-existential methods and values will be important. Perhaps this condemns it to an endless tearing up of itself, like the bridge that I imagined, with the possibility that the addition of an ism at its end, might similarly condemn a post-existential approach to the kind of closing down it seeks to challenge, then this commitment to self-questioning may well be central.
Thank you very much. Therapeutic practice is Rhiannon. Rhiannon's also a practitioner. She did her doctorate on language and experience, and she's talking now about language experience and misrepresentation with particular reference to the case of Lola Voss. Rhiannon.
I'm not... Can you hear me? I feel a bit like I'm going to do karaoke. I suppose I want to kind of start literally where Tom left off, in that I suppose for me, and I think for Dell and the other people that contributed to the book, and is that a therapy without foundations is a curious concept. Because, of course, I suppose when I think of a foundation, I think of something where you dig a big hole and you pour concrete in it and then you put something on top of it. And that thing that stays on top is essentially rooted in its place, unable to move because of what's holding it there. And I think, but of course without it, along comes the first rainstorm and everything gets washed away. And I suppose some might argue that that's perhaps exactly what should happen sometimes. But I think it's the idea of the foundations and what happens and how rigid things can become when we rely entirely on our foundations. So that was, I think, I like Tom's metaphor of the bridge. I thought that was really helpful. And also what Tom was saying about the idea of the good therapy, in inverted commas, and the bad therapy, where bad therapy is ignoring the individuality and the otherness of the other and failing to enter into a dialogue, which can be dehumanising. And a rigid diagnosis may obscure the identity of the other person, leading to a further a lack of sense of their own actual identity. And I think in terms of Lola Voss, coming on to that, I think it's a great example of exactly what happened. It feels like that's what happened in this case. I think it feels like Lola Voss, the case of Lola Voss, is an example how when we hold an incredibly theoretical position, there can sometimes be no actual therapy which takes place. Binswanger's case of Lola Voss is an excellent way to have an insight in some ways into an existential analytic position on subjectivity and the other's relationship to the world. However, if you get the chance to read the actual text itself, the actual therapeutic element is perhaps absent, if that's not too hard. Binswanger introduces Lola Voss at the beginning as a willful, spoilt girl in her mid-20s, who was brought to the sanatorium by her parents after her behaviour deteriorated. But perhaps it's worth mentioning that Lola was told she was going on a trip and then was left in a sanatorium in Switzerland. So there's an element of kind of people and what's happening and all that kind of stuff going on, which is never really addressed. The other things that, the other way that, sorry. So I'm laughing. I started to write this on a piece of paper, and on the final page it says, language is not just a haphazard collection of signs. And then my four-year-old tried to write her name on the next page. And the way she did S, kicking K, smiley face, tail. So maybe language is just a haphazard collection of sounds. I don't know. And three pages of it as well. Lola had a German father and a Spanish mother. She also spoke English and she spoke French. She was brought, as I said, to the sanatorium in Switzerland by her parents, who told her she was going on a trip. Binswanger's interpretation is that she was in flight from the world, that her subjectivity was so in conflict with the world around her that it essentially closed itself down, and therefore, in a sense, she had ceased to exist. And I think in reading the case, she had, or at least certainly she didn't really exist for Binswanger. She became obsessive about language, translating from Spanish into German and into English and finding kind of idiosyncratic meanings. And Binswanger saw this as a kind of symptom of her flight from the world. She was refusing to communicate. She would not engage with him. When I was practicing at the school that I used to work at for learning difficulties, I had a client who had a diagnosis of autism, who spent two of our sessions listing members of staff, first of all just their names, then by surname alphabetically, then by surname alphabetically with their first name, surname alphabetically with the subject that they taught. And I remember going to clinical supervision and saying, he just won't engage with me. How can therapy take place? He won't engage with me in my language, the language I want him to speak. He won't talk to me. And the suggestion was, well, what would happen if you tried to engage with him? If you said, and Mr. Jackson, what does he teach? Instead of trying to force him into my world, to perhaps come alongside and enter into his world with him. So what Lola did is she used to take the words, a good example is gomo in Spanish for rubber, and mano, hand, and she put them together in reference to the rubber tip on a cane and made no go in English. And Binns found that this was puzzling, what she was creating. So she saw the rubber tips on canes as a warning sign. Shouldn't go near them. Shouldn't go near them. They were no go. As opposed to the word schirm, excuse my German accent, in German, which in her head she translated as meaning see in Spanish. And Binsfanger just could not engage with this. He found it really difficult. And we're back to the idea that language is perhaps not just a haphazard collection of sounds. And if something about Lola's language and what she was trying to say had been able to enter into it with her, there's the possibility that something else might have happened. And in terms of a therapy without foundations, I suppose what I want to do is consider three different ways in which a different kind of foundation could potentially have opened something up. The difficulty with, obviously, using theory and different approaches is that as soon as we walk round a corner, phenomenologically, we can't see what's around the bend. So I'm aware that by walking in one direction, I'm closing down some other aspects. And as you're sitting here listening, you may think, but what about Derrida? Or what about this sort of a psychoanalytic approach? And I'm aware that, in a sense, those are missing. The first approach that might have been of interest is to consider Lola as a female in her mid-20s, who had been taken to the sanatorium by her parents after her behaviour deteriorated when her fiancé, a Spanish doctor, wasn't able to marry her because he was too poor. So the confusion with language, the Spanish and the English and the German, what we're essentially dealing with is a woman in her mid-20s who is deposited. She's passed freely from one to the other. You know, where is the power, essentially? And thinking about it from a sort of feministic position is one possible interpretation. So the small child, according to Kristeva, the mother is not only active and phallic, but she is omnipotent. However, her omnipotence is essentially a sham, because it exists only in a patriarchal society, and therefore the powerful is powerless. And I think there's something about, potentially, the translation from Spanish into English and the warning signs and the playing with the languages of her parents, playing with the German and playing with the Spanish, and trying to figure out where the authority is, who has the authority, who has the power. I'm aware also of a possible analytic take on her obsession with umbrellas and canes and all that type of stuff, but you know, that it's just the idea that you might open something up when you think of who she was. And who she was is kind of not present in this case study. Her playing with words is perhaps an idea of a misrepresentation, how traditional language misrepresents, that there must be a hidden meaning somewhere, and her search for a hidden meaning that Binsfanger, for his own reasons, could not engage with her, and he retreated into theory instead. The other thing that came to mind is, in order to protect my mother, I kill myself. And I think there's something about, in relation to power and the superficial nature, perhaps, of female power, potentially, in this instance, that just comes to mind. I'm not sure why. It perhaps, just like the case of Lola Voss, perhaps says more about Binsfanger than it does about Lola Voss. Perhaps that says far more about me than it does about either Binsfanger or Lola Voss. But it's one thing to perhaps consider. The second approach, which perhaps in terms of foundations might be valid, is to consider the physicality of Lola Voss, her physical presence, almost in a sort of Merleau-Pontian way, the idea that the body is there as a starting point. The sensory experience is perhaps primary, whether it's visual or whether it's literal sensation on your skin. And one of Lola's obsessions was to refuse to change her clothes. Again, these were clothes that had been bought for her by her parents, who had dumped her in a sanatorium in Switzerland, and okay, we can get into all of that. But I think what's also perhaps opening up is, what do new clothes feel like as opposed to old clothes? What do new clothes smell like as opposed to old clothes? You know, a new clothes a little bit scratchy. You know, when you put on a new collar and you put on new stays, particularly for someone like that, what does it feel like? Is it easier and more comfortable, and it feels more familiar to wear something which you've worn for months? Is it an idea of an individual who's refusing to engage with the world? She's refusing to put on a social front? Or is it somebody who's just in a physical place where the familiar feels more comfortable? And I think, you know, Binswanger was very keen on this, the idea that she would not change her clothes. She refused to change her clothes. But at no point was there any sense of what it was like to be Lola physically living in the world. And I think the third approach, in a sense, that perhaps is it comes out of this and it links to what Tom is saying, is the idea of the relational, really, in terms of the fact that what was it like to be with her in the room? There's no sense of that in this case. And instead, what we have is an excellent presentation of existential analytic theory. But we have no sense of what it was like to sit with Lola in a room and try and engage with her. There's no evidence that there was any person-to-person relation between Dr. Binswanger and his client or patient, Lola Voss. And I think, interestingly as well, the reason why this case interests me is because she just disappears. She leaves the sanatorium, and he keeps in contact with her by letter a little bit. But other than that, we never know what happens to Lola Voss. She just is an unfinished narrative in a lot of ways. And in that way, it's curious that Binswanger would use this as an example of his therapy, because it wasn't a raging success, I would say. It wasn't a sort of validation of a therapeutic approach. It's an incredible validation of his theory, of his foundations, but it's certainly not a therapeutic case study. And that, I suppose, is fascinating. And I think, therefore, when we think about therapy without foundations, for me, what we're not saying is just go into a room and be with someone. Just be. Don't think about Freud and Lacan and Kristeva and Derrida. It's just none of it's important. We're not trying to kind of sweep it all away. But I think what I feel we're trying to say in this chapter particularly, it feels like what Tom's trying to say, is that when we cling too rigidly to these foundations, perhaps violence takes place and the sense of the otherness of the other disappears. And what perhaps would be an interesting approach is to hold open the possibility of the theory, but hold it there as possibility, and not get so caught up with the foundation of your therapy that it has a detrimental effect on the being in a room with another person. And for me, that is perhaps as close as I will be able to come to a therapy without foundations.
Rhiannon, so now calling on Haya to respond to both of the talks from Tom and Wim.
I should have listened to Twiggy. I was telling Audrey and David earlier on the coffee break, and I had some of you will know who Twiggy is, when you said in fashion. Well, watching the 1970s fashion, filling the shops, I didn't like at the time, not particularly like that. I was very relieved that Twiggy said, if you remember wearing it first time round, you're probably too old to wear it now. Didn't have to. I feel a bit like this coming here today. 45 years ago, I was involved in conversations exactly like the ones taking place today in my training, believe it or not. And, I was one of two first trainees around which the PA psychotherapy training started. It was me and Paul Zill. We were the first ever formal psychotherapy trainees of the Philadelphia Association, and now Dale is my great-grandson of the tradition. I have very mixed feelings about... Anyhow, here I am, not listening to Twiggy. Dale had asked me to respond to the chapters which Tom and Ren wrote in the book, and so I think their talks are pretty in line with the chapters. So if you hear me refer to something that you didn't hear today, just go and read the book, because it will all be there in the chapter. And I've written it down because I had to confine myself to 15 minutes, and as you can see already, I can go on forever, so it's the only way to contain myself. And I'll try and fit in within the time. I'd like to start by thanking both speakers for so eloquently putting back into the prevailing psychotherapy discourse some of the fundamental questions which underpin the philosophical presuppositions at the heart of the enterprise. In no other time in our collective history have these issues been more relevant than at this point in time, when we are in danger of being seduced into signing on the dotted line, which would lead us into the imaginary promised land of so-called certainty, transparency, competencies, and jobs in the NHS. Not gonna happen. My allocated 15 minutes couldn't possibly do justice to all the issues raised in the two papers, and the best I can do is to list and highlight some and attempt to address one or two briefly before giving you the chance to comment. Rhiannon's revisiting of the Lola Voss case and her critique of Binswanger's handling of it raises at least three fundamental issues highly relevant to psychotherapy in general and to the treatment of psychosis and schizophrenia in particular. First one is, if one perceives the patient as having withdrawn from the so-called social reality they are expected to operate within, where do they go to? Is there another reality they live in? And what is the nature of the new reality the patient has allegedly retreated into? Is this other reality part of the world we live in, or are there many worlds, each with a separate reality, a la Carlos Castaneda? And most of all, do we simply write them off as having left our world, or do we accept, validate, and attempt to learn the language spoken in the territory they have allegedly retreated to? The second big issue is, does intelligibility rule out psychopathology? Ignoring Lola's exposure to three or four languages and the possible personal dynamics that this contributed to might well have been a serious omission on Binswanger's part. However, intimating that Lola's way of being in the world may be common to all multilingual children and adults is in danger of trivializing her pathology, particularly if we remember that pathology comes from pathos, which means suffering. This highlights the wider question of intelligibility. Being able to make sense of the patient's speech is by definition vital if one is to attempt to engage in the talking cure of whichever denomination. But it doesn't by itself affect a quote-unquote cure, nor does it cancel out the symptom or the suffering. The paper highlights the all-important question of language. Does it constitute us? Is it our master? Is there no thing when the word is missing? Is there a preferable world where a human being is outside the spoken world? Or is human environment essentially situated in language? These are but some of the ongoing philosophical questions with clinical implications which are in grave danger of being forgotten, overlooked, or worse still, denied, if as we join in what Tom Cotton called the eagerness to sit at the same empirically validated scientific table as the neurogenetic research industry, medical model-aligned orientations of psychotherapy. And finally, would a new orientation, a post-existential one, really allow for a new relationship between language and experience? And how do we feel about an orientation which starts with a belief in the innate nature of human creativity? I wish to move on to Tom's paper. I find myself in the awkward position of commenting on a research for which I was one of the research subjects in an area of self-confessed great professional and personal involvement. I was much relieved to read page 111 in the book when Tom asks how much of the research participants' meaning has been reduced, compressed, and ultimately transformed one way or another by the interpretation of the researcher. But most of all, I was perplexed and exercised by the question, what is a Kingsley Hall? For that matter, what is an R.D. Lang? Was the research and its findings designed for looking at an individual man, one of his ideas, his theories, his qualities as an analyst, his personality? Or is his name used as an icon for a movement, a historical phenomenon linked to a much greater historical movement which started in the early 60s and culminated with the events of 1968, one which included the sociocultural challenge to the grand narrative, to mental and big academic institutions, to the unlocking of hospital wards by Maxwell Jones, and the birth of the therapeutic community movement within and outside the NHS? Is the research using the name Kingsley Hall in relation to a specific social experiment which took place at a specific time in a specific house in East London? Or is Kingsley Hall another icon, a signifier to the start of a mental health revolution which, seen in the context of the socio-cultural events of the time, signaled the point of no return in the way we think, speak of, and treat the mentally ill? For those who are not familiar with the mental health provisions of the 50s and 60s, and those who prefer to forget, it may not be so clear why, how we treat one another would be such an important issue leading to such a bloody revolution, which happened to be set in the midst of the psychedelic and flower power era. After all, the research makes no distinction between those subjects who lived and worked at Kingsley Hall and those who worked in subsequent houses for the next 4 years. I actually arrived at Kingsley Hall, I think, began to run at 67. I arrived in August 68. I've been to Kingsley Hall twice. I visited a friend who was living and working there, and I came to one of the series of many, you know, end of Kingsley Hall parties that sometimes went on for a few days. So I actually came to one of those. So that was, you know, I just arrived in London in August 68, and that was one of my ports of call. I'd read The Divided Self on the way over here and thought, that's an interesting book. I might give this man a call. I had no idea of his notoriety. And he said, come for lunch. And you've got interesting ideas. Do you want to work with us? So I was interviewed about Kingsley Hall. My experience of therapeutic community started, as I said, after Kingsley Hall, and for the next 20 years of my involvement with the Pillay, which ended 15 years ago. If a Kingsley Hall or an R.D. Lang are but icons for a movement, I wish to put forward the proposition that far from being a failed experiment, the very fact that we are here today talking about the issues we are talking about in the company we keep and under this roof is proof of how hugely successful it has been in, quote, driving us out of our wretched minds, as Ronnie would call it, and opening our collective eyes to how we treat one another, and in particular those others who have great difficulty in considering themselves, let alone themselves in relation to others. Now, Kingsley Hall did close down incidentally, not because the resident non-therapist had had enough, or the resident non-patients had gone into hospital or had committed suicide. The lease on the building ran out. But this is neither here nor there. The historical fact is that the experiment was so successful and so much was learned from it that community household, under the auspices of the then formed Philadelphia Association, was set up all over town and beyond, including a series in Archway designed to house those resident non-patients who lost the tenancy of the old Kingsley Hall building, but continue to operate as a community. Now, we designated therapists chosen by them and house rules made by them. And I was one of the therapists who was invited by the residents to say, you know, our current therapist is leaving, would you be our therapist? And so my colleague Paul Zill and myself took that on, and we're therapists to three derelict buildings for the following 7 years. At the same time, and very much inspired by the good and the bad of the Kingsley Hall experiment, a group which broke away from the Philadelphia Association formed the Albers Association, which, like the PA, is still, to this day, operating communities with a difference, ones where the residents are called guests, and where hospitality is extended rather than hospitalization. And later on, some of the teaching that started in the Kingsley Hall experiment moved on to the creation of the SPSY, of the Guild of Psychotherapists, and a variety of places where the likes of us are still teaching a different way of working, we call psychoanalytically, existentially, phenomenologically, with psychosis. And so on. It is interesting to note that in the days of Kingsley Hall and since, the prevailing discourse was always an attempt to understand what was going on within, between, and around the socially disenfranchised, whether it was done with the use of LSD, group meetings, individual and group therapy, and however confused, misleading, and misled some of it might have been at the time. Do not get me wrong, there is much to critique about the specific Kingsley Hall experiment and the idea that being with in a non-hierarchical way is all you need to see someone through their personal hell. But far from being resistant to critique, both Arbers and the PA houses have undergone many creative changes over the years, having to cope with constant revisiting of ideologies, personalities, cultural, social, and political changes, not least within the field of psychotherapy and mental health alike. Far from being consigned to the lunatic fringe by mainstream health, quote from the chapter, local health authorities, in conjunction with housing associations, have forked out millions over the years to pay for some residents to live in these houses, the very offspring of the Kingsley Hall phenomena. This does not change the fact that dealing with some has been endlessly frustrating and at cross purposes. But this is in the nature of the beast, as the state and psychoanalysis are working in diametrically opposed aims and directions. It was Lang's sometimes outrageous and provocative writings and the happenings in Kingsley Hall which attracted young doctors and others to congregate around the founder members, and which led to the formation of the PA and later Arbers psychotherapy trainings. It is also interesting to note that most independent, creative, and innovative psychotherapy organizations in this country were formed around that time. They're all post-1968 revolutionary creations. Over 40 years on, we now know the problems inherent in voluntary organizations formed on ideology and created around the charismatic figurehead. But it would be a grave error to think that this was specific to Lang or the PA. However, to be fair, we must return to the idea that the treatment is how we treat one another. But we must place it in its proper theoretical, cultural, analytical context. Lang, individual or icon, is accused of failing to provide, quote, a credible alternative system of treatment. This is absolutely true. The man did not leave behind a manualized, systematized, standard edition for the treatment of schizophrenia. But he did leave a legacy, which has continued to evolve non-stop with academic and clinical rigor for over 40 years, drawing on psychoanalytic understanding with an ongoing phenomenological critique of some of its premises and metapsychology. One which does not see individuals as isolated entities and tries to explain their interaction by complex geometrical superstructures, but one which sees intersubjectivity as a field we are all subjected to, and where whichever church of psychotherapy we belong to, treatment cannot take place without the mindfulness of how we treat one another, how we engage, converse, and offer hospitality to the uniqueness of the individual's structure, dynamic, sociocultural, and sexual way of being in the world. Never more so than when we deal with psychosis, where the formation of the subject is the main problem at hand. And yes, I do believe that diagnosis and knowing through is essential for the above to take place. Good or bad, none of this can be packaged neatly, nice approved, and neatly dispensed by your GP, and maybe just as well.
Before Rhiannon and Tom to respond, if they wish to, do you have some comments, thoughts, statements from the floor? Very, very helpful.
Here you go.
About this bridge, foundations, etc. I think most of you will remember the old story about London bridges falling down, and every time they built it up, it fell down again. Now, the reason it fell down was that they had failed to do one essential thing, and that was to kill a newborn baby and put it under the foundations. So this seems to me to suggest that perhaps people are being a little too timid in their attempts to improve psychotherapy, but what we have to do is something quite radical about the existing system, to more or less assassinate the existing system before something that will stand up can be built on its ruins.
Thank you.
Freud also had he used the metaphor of a bridge, and he used it in the context of, basically he was saying if you don't have the correct theory, you might as well build a bridge of cardboard as you would of steel. So he kind of used it in that context, you know, and of course, you know, and as soon as you enter into the real world, one works and one doesn't. So,
shall we just take a couple more questions for this one?
I worked in therapeutic communities, and I think coming from a Middle Eastern culture and then coming to Western culture, I realized this preoccupation with defining things. We have to define things. We have to define that someone has schizophrenia. We have to define that someone is a client and someone is a therapist. And I think I realized in therapeutic communities that instead of defining, we're open to discuss. And I really like that, because I think having a diagnosis or not is irrelevant, but I think being open to discuss how it is for that person and how it is for us to be with that person in a world, I think it opens up and we realize that we do not allow these people to exist in our, what we understand to be our existence. Like, for example, walking in London Underground and seeing someone pace up and down and talking to themselves, you see everybody's reacting to the person and they look at them and they frown. But in the end, I think we're all sitting there having paranoid thoughts about someone staring at us, someone thinking something about us, and you know, all of these thoughts. But I think it's this exclusion of differing experiences. And I think that's what I've learned from therapeutic communities, that, you know, it's irrelevant if diagnosis is useful or not and all of these things, or whether we need to have a foundation or not, but I think to use it and be open for the person. And I think that's what I liked about what she also said about the language. How is it to sit in that room with that person and my ideas of that person? Am I open to that person?
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Julie Kane. I'd just like to say something about theory, which has come to me in response to a couple of other people who just said here about London Bridge falling down. I immediately thought of Ring a Ring of Roses and we all fall down. And actually, perhaps that sort of took me to the idea that what we perhaps haven't begun to do yet here is to think about what is theory, actually. What is it? And that actually it's just a story. It's just a story. And we maybe are in danger of elevating it to something that it isn't. I'm not saying it's not of use, but it's of no more use than any other story, like an episode of EastEnders, for example. And I think that's kind of hugely problematic. The other thing, I suppose, in terms of falling down, is stories do fall down. They do fail us, but those may be the most creative moments in therapy, when our kind of well-worn pathways to theory kind of let us down. And as somebody called Kierkegaard, perhaps we then have to start to think for ourselves. I just wanted to kind of raise that question about theory and what it means.
Thank you. Perhaps we could start to get, before taking more questions, some responses, either to what I said or people from here. Who would like to start?
Yeah, just turn it on at the back.
Just really quickly, it's what you were saying about knots. I'd never heard of a Langian knot before Tom spoke of it. I suppose the only metaphorical, historical knot I know is that sort of the Gaudian knot. And of course, the only way to unpick the Gaudian knot was to take a massive, great, enormous axe to it. And just cut it in half, essentially, rather than trying to unpick it. And I think, as Tom was talking about that, that's what made me think of it. And I think definitely in terms of foundations, and you know, perhaps it's difficult to try and unpick something without completely destroying it. But I think the purpose of all of this is not necessarily to try and destroy it. It's the creativity rather than the destructiveness. And it's not necessarily to say, well, it's all no good, so we're just going to get rid of all of it. Because in a sense, that doesn't make any sense either. The possibility for me of therapy with no foundation is the therapy without a rigid foundation. It's remembering that it's just a story, that the story of Lola as a female in her mid-20s dealing with power structures in 1910 Switzerland, or the story of an individual girl who's been let down by her fiancé, or whatever it is, and an analytic approach. These are just stories, and they can be helpful, but they can be unhelpful. And although it's really tempting to take a massive sword and just do away with it all, the question is then, why do that? Why do we need to do it? We may do. Who knows? But I'm not sure. But I like the idea of a Langian knot. I've never heard that.
Sorry.
Thank you. I mean, I think the idea of story is a very important one. And perhaps it's because of my previous life as a filmmaker that I'm very much obsessed with the idea of story and what story represents. But I think it's absolutely central to the notion of what it is that we attempt to do in psychotherapy. We're working with stories, and the way that we attempt to work with stories is our own particular story about how to approach that story. And I think being able to understand that theory as a story, it's a story that fits, but it's a story that ultimately needs to be disposed of when it's no longer useful. And that you need to reframe it, you need to look at new stories. So I think that's definitely something I find very appealing. And I suppose in one sense the question for me is, are we able to enter into this exchange, this dialogue about these disposable stories, without first being versed in some kind of theoretical story in the first place? So can we ever get beyond that? And is that something that we need to do? I just wanted to respond to what you were saying earlier, Haya, about that in one sense one could look at the events of Kingsland Hall and how it worked, and that one interpretation of that is something that didn't work. But that what followed from that, both in terms of the communities that came after Kingsley Hall, and the community that I work in at the moment is very much part of that tradition. So it's obviously something that I'm very much immersed in and I find incredibly valuable. Having also worked for a long time now, but having worked in what was at the time a very repressive psychiatric setting, and one that was very, very different, and one that I would never want to return to personally. But also in terms of the ideas that we're talking about, this is all part of a tradition, and it's a tradition of questioning and attempting to be open to something. And I do find that sadly in the mainstream system of treatment, this is something that is not encouraged. In fact, it's actively discouraged, because in a mainstream setting we're very much dictated to by the principles of money, economics, and the desire for certainty and predictability. And the fact that there is very little space for this kind of questioning, I think, is a real problem. Disastrous, even. Yeah.
My name is Peter Wallace. I'm a psychotherapist. I was listening to what you were saying, Haya, and realising that I am the product of a training centre that was founded, I think, in the 60s by someone who was part of the countercultural movement. But I think we're also in a sense, up a creek without a paddle, in the sense that I was wondering, where has everybody in this room come from? How did each one of us come here? Nobody could have intended this meeting. And the sort of way in which we're talking is that, in a sense, you cannot create something, you cannot intend to create something, because if it has a life of its own, it becomes something, not an institution, it becomes something of its own. And we're talking about people perhaps becoming themselves, and that is not something we can intend for them or for ourselves to extend. So we're talking about ourselves as sort of, in a sense, countercultural. How was this meeting created? How come everybody who is here? In a sense, it's an explosion, it's an accident. We just simply happen to go here at this moment in time. So if we're thinking about how do we plan, how do we create something new, it's a very big and very difficult question. I'm also struck by how much study has probably gone on within the lives of the people in this room, and how much we've had to study in order to come to a point of thinking about theory, of thinking about intention, in a sense, in these ways. We are wanting people to discover themselves, so we can't program that. It's hard to create a movement. If you create a movement, you're defining something which is against, in a sense, the culture of what we're talking about. I wonder how we square all of this, if we can.
Delving into it earlier, I'm actually an art historian originally, and I suppose from that perspective, I really struggle with that a little bit. I suppose in terms of the intentionality and the creativity and the idea that things have a life of their own, there's one of the most dominant art history theories in terms of creativity is that it's a mixture between us. Della, I bang on about this quite a lot, about making and matching. We don't intend to create a snowman, sure, but when we see a lump of snow, we say to ourselves, well, if I give him a hat and give him a pipe, he'll look like a man. The idea of artistic creation is the idea of walking down the street and seeing a lump of wood and saying, if I just took a little bit off the back, it would look a little bit more like a snail. And then the next man comes along and says, you know what, if I stuck some twigs in the top, it would have antenna and it would really look like a snail. And that's the way we create. So I suppose the idea of things just emerging and having a life of their own is perhaps problematic for me. And I suppose I do see intentionality. And in terms of foundations, I suppose that's where I stand. But I think in some ways we have the privilege of thinking in some ways about pursuing therapy without rigid foundations, because we understand what those foundations are. Just as the I suppose in terms of attachment theory, the ability to separate comes from the place of having been truly attached in the first place. And I suppose that's my first thought, really. Snails and snowmen, that's fine.
I think what I was saying arose partly out of what the lady who spoke first said, that if we overthrew the existing institutions and tried to create another institution, we would simply be creating another, you know, structure of conventionalism and, you know, etc.
Thank you. No,
are you sure you want to give me a microphone?
We got finished by 2 o'clock.
Many years ago, a psychologist from another country came to this country and wanted to visit a Langian community. And so I asked the residents of one of the houses in Archer whether it was okay for a visitor to come. We were quite used to that sort of thing. And they said, yes, you can come to the weekly meeting. And we went to the weekly, she came along with me in my car to the weekly meeting, which took place in one of the three derelict houses. And the topic on the agenda were the residents from, at that time, about 15 to 17 people in from the sublime to the ridiculous states of mind that you can imagine would gather together, have something to eat, and then we had the weekly meeting. Main topic was that there was some money to redecorate, and everybody, it had been agreed that everybody can paint their room whichever colour they like, but there should have to be some agreement about the communal space in the living room and the kitchen. So that was the topic of the evening. There was a discussion about which colour to paint the living room and the kitchen. And at some point we were ready for a vote, and then somebody said, hey, hold on, Pat isn't here. And Pat, who came 2 years earlier with the diagnosis of chronic schizophrenia, had spent the whole evening walking in and out of the room, slamming the door and saying things that you would normally say, like, you're all Martians, I'm the only human being here, you know, and so on, as was Pat's way, which nobody took an awful lot of notice of, because that's what Pat did. However, when it came to the vote, somebody said, oh, hold on a minute, Pat isn't here. So somebody ran upstairs and got Pat from her room to take part in the vote about what colour to paint the kingdom of space. And so on and so forth. And that was basically the gist of the evening. So on the drive back, I felt a little bit sorry that it wasn't very exciting, and it was a rather boring kind of evening for this visitor from abroad. However, the woman was beside herself with excitement. And she said, I don't believe this, you know, I've never seen anything like this. I was a bit embarrassed because it wasn't so obvious to me what it was she was so excited about. You know, because despite the obvious, you didn't have to be a psychiatrist to see that Pat was what the psychiatrist would call as active schizophrenic, and for whom we were all Martians and so on and so forth. First of all, nobody saw that related in any way, shape, or form to her right to have a say about what colour the living room should be. And she herself did not think that she didn't have a say, or, you know. It was immaterial. And so, if you like to put some posh words on it, the idea that everybody was respected as a human being who might have a view about what colour and when they wanted to get up, so on and so forth, was at that, by that point so taken for granted, we didn't even notice it, didn't consider it as therapeutic, as important. However, having said that, if I was Pat's personal therapist and as a therapist to the community, and if I was to deal with Pat's delusion that we were all Martians, Martians, and she was the only human being, and the rest of it, I would need to do something more. I couldn't do it simply with a respect, a genuine respect. You can't fake that kind of respect. You can't count somebody if you don't really count them. But once you've established that, the work is made possible, but the work still needs to be done. And that's where all our notions, and I must say, I find it very difficult for someone who uses the term phenomenology to suggest that any of us are capable of not having theories. We're full of them, absolutely full of them. Hopefully, we are called upon in our training to spell them out. To say, what is it that we think about human nature, about the human mind, about interaction, about dynamics? Spell them out, have them challenged, rethink them, reinvent what you do with every patient. The difference between us, the autocratic institutions, and the paranoid is that hopefully we can doubt, and we can be doubted, and we can rethink our thoughts every single time with every single patient, and every time we think of opening our mouth in a session.
I think one of the issues is of whether we're in a culture where we can doubt. Okay? And if we can't doubt, then perhaps catastrophe is inevitable. The difficulty is that...
Don't go legit.
The difficulty is that the theories now are meant to be backed by science, aren't they? Not by what we're doing today, and exploring theory in that way, but by some notion of evidence-based. And it's a question of what we do with this. You see, it's people like Freud and Rogers all went along with the whatever was the prevailing game in the day of science, yeah, to prove it. And indeed, that's happening here. I mean, with this building, Peter Fonagy, yeah, very much somebody who's trying to say, you know, whatever CBT can do, psychoanalysis can do, and yeah, whether it be manualization or RCTs or what have you. So there's a question of how far we go along that game. But we can clearly see it's not what I think people in this room think we're about. And when we start talking about how we treat each other, about language, about representation, experience, then we're talking about how we are with each other. And I was very interested in the conversation how violence came very quickly into it. And there is the issue of the world we're in at the moment, you know, that it's breaking up in some ways, isn't it? The old order is going, you know, the West, you know, is going. The European funding mechanisms, all the banking is going. There's how we treat each other and how if we can allow thoughts in as to how we treat each other. What about notions of public service, for example? Yeah? Can we really start thinking about those as we used to, or in a different way than we are? And how we treat others outside of our culture. Look at the horrible violence of our foreign policy, which we don't even think about too much. So I think there's possibilities, there's potentials here with regard to something else emerging. I hope it's not too violent, but I think we're close to potentially something else happening. And hopefully what we're saying today about our relationships, how we treat each other, about language, representation and experience might come through a bit more.